This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Even though he was charged with murder, Lamont Armstrong never expected to go to prison. He knew he was innocent, and he thought the facts would bear that out. He was wrong. Lamont was convicted by a Greensboro jury in 1995 of murdering a family friend and former professor named Ernestine Compton. He had no motive. There was no forensic evidence tying Lamont to the crime. What the prosecution had was the word of an informant who, it turns out, was pressured by the police to testify against Lamont. Lamont Armstrong was sent to prison and stayed there 17 years. But this year, he got out. His release followed years of hard work by lawyers and students with Duke University's Wrongful Convictions Clinic. Law and Order Week continues here on The State of Things, and Lamont Armstrong is here to tell us his story. Lamont, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
When did you first hear about the murder of Ernestine?
If I'm not mistaken, it was 3 or 4 days later. And I had been partying or hanging out in Winston-Salem. And I got back home, and I called my mom to see how she was doing, and she told me that Professor Compton had been killed. And I said, well, how are you? And she says, I'm shook up. I said, I'll be home in a few minutes to see how you are. And I took off home. And then she began to explain to me what she knew, which was very little other than what she had heard on television or the radio and in the newspaper. So I got that brief, and my whole family was in shock.
And as you suggest, she was a family friend and a professor at A&T. And was she your professor?
Yes, she was. She taught me. I graduated from North Carolina A&T in physical education, recreation. And she was one of my professors. She also did, I spent 2 years, almost 3 years in New York City teaching school. At that time, I didn't have to have any lesson plans, and had really forgotten how to do them. My mom called her, and she told my mom, send him down here. I'll help him. And I went down to her house, and she told me, boy, what is it that you need? And I told her, and she just did them. 2 days later, she called me back and says, here they are.
Well, and that was, she was known in the community for that. She helped an awful lot of people in that community.
She did, no doubt.
So when did you realize that you were, when did you first realize that you were a suspect in this case?
I was questioned by two Greensboro detectives about 2 weeks after the murder happened. And I paid no attention because of the fact, if I were a detective, I would canvass our whole community also. So I'm a part of the community, so why not question me? But I kept asking them as the questions got deeper, what are you saying? Am I a suspect or something? Are you accusing me? And they kept telling me no. So it was not until 1994 when they arrested me, when I knew I was a suspect.
And this was 1988 when the murder happened, so there's a long time between the murder and the trial itself.
Absolutely. I think it was, 7 years?
Yeah. At some point you did suggest just now that you began to realize that they might be looking at you as a suspect. Was that right? I mean, first you thought, well, yeah, why not ask everybody in the neighborhood? But did you at some point say, wait a minute, do they think I did it?
You know, in all actuality, I did not really think they were looking at me as a suspect. First of all, because the same thing I carried for 17 years, I knew I didn't do it. So why would you be looking at me? I don't have a violent record, so why, you know. I'm just one of the guys in the neighborhood that you asked.
There was no material evidence at the crime scene that linked you to the crime, but strange things started happening that led to your arrest. A man named Charles Blackwell started coming around and asking you questions. When did that happen, and describe what was happening then?
Approximately 2 weeks after they had got me up to the police station and questioned me and didn't let me go. On Fridays, my mom cooked fish, fried fish, every Friday. It's a ritual at my house. So I was driving around in Greensboro, and I thought about today is Friday. I know, oh, boy, Mom's cooking. So I called on the phone. I says, where you at, in the kitchen? She says, yeah, boy, I don't have time to mess with you. I said, well, just fix me a plate. I'll be by there in a minute. And I shot past my mom's house, and I was there, and the doorbell rang, and my younger brother says, he went to the door and came hollered down the hall and said, Lamont, it's for you. And I said to myself, who in the world would know I'm here? So I went down the hall to the living room, to the front door, and it was Charles Blackwell. And he began to ask me for a ride home, and please give me a ride home. Somebody put me out. I said, what are you doing here? Somebody put me out of their car and stranded me down here, and I saw your car parked up in front of the house. And I didn't think at that moment, how does he know what kind of car I got? But I just said, okay, well, okay, you know, I understand, but I'm not taking you home. I don't have any extra gas. Plus, I'm waiting on my mom to cook. And I kept trying to emphasize this, and he kept begging. But he switched the conversation and started asking me questions about the murder down the street. And I replied, I know nothing about the murder. I wasn't in Greensboro. I was in Winston. So why are you asking me all these questions anyway? Did you do it? When I asked him that question, he backed away. He says, no, I didn't do it. I don't know nothing about your community. I says, well, why are you asking me so many questions? I said, listen, man, I think it's time for you to leave. And I'm not taking you home. And they say, I know he finally left. Where he went, who knows? Today, I know where he went. He went back to the police car because he was wired up. The whole time I was talking, I was really telling the police a second time where I'd been.
And did he come back and continue his visits?
My brother said he came back one other time, but he called several times. One time or maybe a couple of times he even talked to me, and I kept questioning him as to, you know, why you keep calling me, man? And one time he even said something so crazy as that we need to get our stories together. I was like, get our stories together? What are you talking about? Man, the police questioned me the other day about that teacher's murder and this, that, and the other. I said, well, that's on you, bro. I don't know nothing about that murder. Same thing I said in the initial conversation, I said in several of those phone conversations that end up being picked up by my lawyer's team.
So they have no material evidence. They have your denial at the police station, and now they have your denial on tape when you don't even know they're listening.
They're listening.
So tell us about the arrest. When did that happen, and what happened?
They arrested me. Well, they got me down to the police station and said they were arresting me for murder. And I said, murder? Who did I murder? And they wouldn't tell me. And I kept saying, I've never murdered anybody. What? I mean, I've never really harmed anybody other than beat them up with my fist a couple of times. You know, I've been in some fights. Murder. They wouldn't tell me. After keeping me in jail that night, the next morning, these two detectives came over to the jail and got me out of the jail, took me across the street to the police station, detective's office, and held me in there and talked to me and asked me all these questions about this murder. And then they told me who I supposedly murdered. And I says, man, Miss Compton, that's my professor, man. I wouldn't murder her. She's just like one of my family members. And then they says, well, Charles Blackwell said you murdered her. And I said, he's a lie. Point blank. He is a lie. And they said, well, he told us you murdered her.
That's the only real evidence they had. That was their case. Tell us about the trial and what your attorneys were telling you going into this trial and how you felt once the trial began, given the case that they had against you.
My attorney told me early on that I wouldn't have to testify, first of all, and that they had no case. They had also, the district court judge had let me out on bond for 30 days or 31 days, I think it was. I spent 31 days in jail with no bond. First-degree murder in North Carolina carries no bond. So at that time, I'm facing death row with no bond, and I get a bond motion. Upon getting a bond motion, come to find out, my lawyer had been to my mom and dad's house and talked to my dad and got him to come to court to bond me out with his home. They got the bond dropped or established from no bond to a $15,000 bond. And my dad made it the next day. So I get out. Now I go from no bond to $15,000 bond. I'm facing death row, but you let me out on bond.
Mm-hmm. No doubt, based on the strength of the case, when the judge took a look. We'll find out more about that. What happened when you heard the verdict, 17 years in jail, in prison, and how it was that you were released. Lamont Armstrong, my guest, finally released from prison in June after spending 17 years behind bars for a crime he didn't commit. We will continue our conversation in a moment. First, we're going to hear some music. Sam Frazier is with us. He's going to play us out, and then we're going to be right back with more on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Sam Frazier.
You're not the only man who'll vanish in the air. By the time you understand, it's way too late to care. Memories mark the seasons, details and dreams ricochet by. That don't add up to the reasons, that don't add up to why. See what I want to see in your eyes, 'cause I know when to look. And try not to act surprised how little time it took. Memories mark the seasons, details and dreams ricochet by. That don't add up to the reasons, that don't add up to why. Just means goodbye, enough rope to hang your head and cry. Hello learns to fly, and maybe why. Past is past, and hope don't mean to lie, but this won't be the last.
This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking with Lamont Armstrong, wrongfully convicted of a murder for which he spent 17 years in prison. He was just released in June. We're going to talk with Teresa Newman as well. She joins us now, a clinical law professor and co-director of Duke Law School's Wrongful Convictions Clinic. She was one of Lamont's attorneys. This is Teresa. Teresa Newman, thank you.
Thank you.
Lamont, I want to talk to Teresa about how she became involved, but there was a trial. You were pretty convinced, and so were your attorneys. There wasn't much of a case here, and yet you were convicted. What was happening to you? How did you feel when the jury came back with that verdict?
Pretty much I felt devastated. And pretty much I did. I just took the hardest blow I'd ever taken in life. None of the blows I took on athletic fields could compare with what just happened. I gazed up and down the jury row, staring at the jurors, trying to figure out to myself, did you just hear what I just heard? Evidently, you people heard something different. And then all of a sudden, my daughter's mother started screaming. And I turned around and waved at her as if to say, you know, don't cry, don't holler. I got it. Well, I lied. I didn't have it. There's no way in the world I had this 17 years in me It was bigger than me, matter of fact. I'm grateful to be sitting here on this program, free, yes, but also alive and hopefully healthy.
Yeah. Well, Teresa Newman, let me ask you how your clinic became involved in this case.
This case was referred to us along with a number of other cases from a nonprofit in Durham, the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, and we didn't know much about the case when we received it. We received two murder by strangulation cases, which this is one of them, that happened in 2 months apart in 1988, 1 mile apart. Both victims were middle-aged African-American women who loaned money to young men and in generosity, in generous spirits. And the Greensboro police thought they were related at one point, so we decided to, when we received them, we decided to investigate them as if they were committed by the same perpetrator. That didn't get us very far, so we received the case about 6 years ago and separated them and started to focus on the cases individually. And as soon as we did, in the other case, the man was convicted in 1989, so right afterward. He was identified quickly. We believe him to be innocent as well, and that could be another program. But in Lamont was convicted 7 years later. But the miraculous part about that is that means that his case file is still intact. The other man's file has been destroyed. The evidence has been destroyed. So we had a rich amount of resources to sort of pour through in Lamont's case and became convinced pretty quickly that something had gone terribly wrong in his case.
What was it? What was it in going through that evidence or that case that convinced you this was a wrongful conviction?
Well, my colleague, Jim Coleman, and I are pretty demanding faculty members. We think we're well-loved, but we're demanding. And we require the students who work with us to develop these documents, these exhaustive documents that chronicle the evidence in a case, the witness, the evolution of a witness statement. So, for example, Mr. Blackwell, and we should say that Mr. Blackwell has long since recanted his testimony against Lamont. He's taken it back. But, for example, the students put Mr. Blackwell's many statements side by side and realized that a strange thing happened in it, is that he knew nothing at the beginning and he knew more later. And that could be because he's holding things in and revealing them slowly, or that he's learning more about the case. And we decided the latter was true, and we're happy to report that we were right, but it took some time to unravel that.
And Charles Blackwell, in fact, recanted several times throughout the process. It wasn't after the conviction, but during the process, before the trial.
Before the trial.
So the police knew, the prosecutor knew that he had recanted. He had gone public. He had talked to churches. He had told everybody that what he said about Lamont wasn't true.
That is correct. And yet he testified against Lamont at trial after he recanted. So, and this happens, this sounds horrible, and it is horrible, and it's very difficult for me and for all of my students who worked on Lamont Armstrong's case to hear Lamont talk about the 17 years, but it's fairly common that there are these men, mostly men and women in prison, who for one reason or another, self-serving interests, testify against other people. And Mr. Blackwell did try to do the right thing. He first got Lamont's name in the case because he just wanted a reward money. And he says that, and he was wired up, and the defense was never given those tapes. So that was a dark day in Greensboro's history, but there's light now. So, but that is right. He tried to do the right thing, but he did testify because they charged him with murder first. And he didn't, as he has said on a tape to Lamont, he couldn't carry a murder charge. I'm sorry I testified against you, but I couldn't carry the murder charge.
So, in effect, he was coerced into testifying. Police charged him with a crime and then offered him a deal. Testify against Lamont, and we can drop the charges. Isn't that how that happened?
That is how it happened, yes.
Withholding what I think you, in your business, call exculpatory evidence, the recordings of him, that didn't get to the jury. Is that a violation of your code? But not your personal code, but
not, not my personal. It is a violation of my personal code, but it doesn't carry much weight in the courthouse.
Yeah.
It is a violation of, it's a constitutional violation. So it's called a Brady violation, that the state is obligated to turn over to the defense any evidence in its possession. And this, that means the state writ large. So that's in the possession of the police or any other investigative agency or in the prosecutor's possession, have an obligation to turn that over to the defense if it exculpates, tends to show that the defendant is innocent. And now North Carolina now has open file discovery in cases like this, so that's, you know, that's much better. But yes, those are, and we made all those allegations in the motion that we submitted in December, and we were going to have a hearing scheduled. He wouldn't even be out because this hearing was scheduled for September 4th until the new evidence was discovered.
I want to talk about that in just a second, but Lamont, I want to ask you what you were doing all this time, because you were active in trying to get help because you knew you were innocent. Tell us about what was going on in those 17 years for you in trying to get outside help to review your case.
I started a writing campaign from day one of hitting Central Prison. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote and I kept writing, trying to get someone to believe or to listen. Apparently, I was writing upon closed eyes and deaf ears. Because for, 11 years, no one would seem to hear anything I was saying. And I was sending them letters and FBI DNA sheets and letters from a judge. A judge wrote a letter about me saying that he knew I was innocent and that I was in here serving a sentence for a crime I did not do. However, I don't know what I can do for you at this time.
Teresa, what can we do? I mean, clearly, because there are people in prison who are guilty and insist they aren't, and they might be writing to you as well. So I'm guessing you get a lot of mail. I'm curious to know how you sort through these and what you would do to expedite these claims, many of which deserve attention, some of which don't, obviously.
They do deserve attention. And we are very fortunate at Duke to have these very talented students, many of whom, in Lamont's case, graduated and yet stayed on the case when they went off to big city law firms in New York City, and they spent thousands of hours. We recognize that the police departments and the prosecutor's offices don't have those thousands of hours to spend on a case. What we would request and what we try to do, is, which worked so well in your case here in Greensboro, is that we would request that people entertain the possibility that a mistake has been made and just allow us into their, say, living rooms, but not living rooms, but allow us into their conference rooms at the prosecutor's office and just listen to what we have to say. And, again, entertain the possibility that an error has been made and then join us in correcting an error once we show them. That, and before that, don't use a parade of what we call incentivized witnesses, who are jailhouse, not snitches, because Lamont corrects me, is snitches telling the truth. This is a jailhouse informant or jailhouse fabricator, as we now call them. But don't let that be your only evidence. Have some corroborative evidence before you allow that to be used in court.
Well, you know, in this business, we can't pay people for their story. That's highly unethical. The idea that you can offer something of value to somebody who's in jail, like a reduced sentence or a better treatment, and then take their testimony is, I will just say, preposterous. There are legal systems in the world, throughout the world, that simply don't allow it for the obvious reason. We can get to some of that in a minute, but I want to find out about this new evidence because, in fact, Guilford County, the prosecutor and the police did entertain the idea and were very helpful, albeit 17 years later, in reopening this case. So tell us what happened.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary. They have been helpful in the last few years. So you have a Detective Mike Matthews and Assistant District Attorney Howard Newman have been open. They're not pushovers. I call Detective Matthews a cop's cop. I've never said that so he could hear it before. And ADA Newman is a prosecutor. So they're not pushovers. They didn't give me the key to the prison, but they did entertain the possibility that an error had been made. When they were preparing for the evidentiary hearing on all of these constitutional claims in September, they decided to reinvestigate. Mike Matthews did a reinvestigation and ran the latent prints, the prints left on the scene that didn't match Lamont, didn't match anyone at the time. And they called me 2 weeks before Lamont, in the beginning of June, and said, Can you come to a meeting? You and my co-counsel, David Pitchko, come to a meeting. We have a match against a very telling palm print in the case, which was left directly above the victim's body.
Well, tell us about that palm print, because they did check that print back in 1988 when the crime occurred, and it wasn't a match. It would later match. We know who committed this crime. It matched his hand. They checked it against that back in 88, right? And it didn't match?
Not exactly in 88, but they did check it before they charged Lamont, specifically against the individual that it now has matched.
And who's he? Tell us who that is.
He's now deceased. He at that time was a 20-year-old man, Greensboro native, addicted to crack cocaine. His name is Chris Cavanis. And he was convicted. He confessed to killing his father 6 months later, about a mile away in Greensboro. So in January of 1989, he killed his father and went to prison. And I feel for his family. And maybe they're not listening to this program,
right.
But I do feel for his family, because they had to be told that he now is, even though he's deceased, that he is the suspect now in
and was a suspect early on because of the proximity. These two crimes were similar in how they were carried out, and they were about 6 months apart.
That is correct, and that she was known to the family. So yeah. Ms. Compton knew Mr. Cavanis, and there's other evidence that I don't want to talk about that implicates him.
But the palm print didn't come up as a match then. It did more recently. What changed?
I don't know. I mean, that's a really excellent question. What we've been told is that, one thing that changed is this was an automated system now. It's a new system that has palm prints in it. So you run palm prints through it. They got a match, and then they did multiple, if anybody who was at the hearing heard this, multiple confirmations that it was a match. I think all they did back then was do a visual, and I don't know why, but think about it. Somebody didn't make a match in 1993-92, and that would have meant that the right person stayed in prison longer, and Lamont never would have been charged.
Lamont, when you heard there was a match, did you know who it was, or did they just tell you that there was a match?
Professor Newman told me it was a match, and I froze, not knowing what to say or do. And all of a sudden, it came across my mind, can they find this person? And she said, Lamont, they found him. He was deceased in 2010. And I was like, what? He's dead? And she told me, yes, he's already dead. And I said, this is a God thing. And I said, we've already done all the work to go to court September 4th. But this is something totally different. So what does it mean? And she says, you're going home soon. This was too much.
Did you believe it?
Not really. It's hard to believe. Yeah. It's kind of hard. But I'm looking at her, and I'm looking at the other attorney, and they're looking at each other, and they're smiling. And they're saying, you're going home.
So tell us how it finally happened. There was a hearing, but it was expedited. As you say, a lot of the process was cut short because of this new evidence. What happened?
The ADA, Assistant District Attorney Howard Newman, said, so there it is. Lamont wasn't with us. We were here in Greensboro in his conference room. And we, at that meeting, and Detective Matthews was there, we decided that we would amend our motion, add this to it, and hold a hearing as soon as possible. And again, to their credit, they really found the date. That was the earliest the judge could do it, June 29th. We had 2 o'clock. We had a hearing, and the judge, it's a great quote from the judge, said he was the closest to doing justice that he has ever felt he's done in his entire career.
Although, what do you make of a statement like that? On the one hand, yes, it's so clear. On the other hand, a man has spent 17 years in prison and this is as close to justice as you get. It does suggest that there's something about this system that needs a little work, wouldn't you say? It's broke, you just mouthed. Yeah.
It's broke.
Yeah.
The system is broke. It needs to be revamped.
Teresa, what about this? I mean, is there any move at least not to allow testimony that's been paid for by the prosecution? Is there even...
You always ask the tough questions. We are at Duke and other innocence organizations in the state, the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, work in policy as well. So this is something we're looking at. I don't think it'll be disallowed in my lifetime because it's a way to shortcut litigation, right? So you get there quickly if you have somebody who can say, oh, he confessed to me in prison.
Albeit the wrong person, and the person who committed the crime is still on the street, so they're not any safer. In fact,
let me
ask you, Lamont, what's your situation now? Has this been expunged from your record? Are you still technically and legally guilty of this crime? What's the next step legally for you? Is it on your record?
I don't think it is. The charge itself has been dropped from my record. Somebody pulled me up on a computer the other day on the prison systems thing website, and they had taken my picture off, so that's a good thing. But I think still, if the DA wanted to, he could recharge me.
As one Facebook page you do not want to be on, I can understand that. What are you doing these days now that you're out?
I'm a substance abuse counselor for Freedom House Recovery Center in Chapel Hill, I'm sorry. But we have one in Durham, too. But I work as a substance abuse counselor.
How is it for you being out?
It's new, sometimes confusing. And I even told Professor Newman the first week, and sometimes scary. Because I don't want to make a mistake. I don't want to offend anyone. I just want to, you know, try my best to do as I've done for a long time now. And let's just try to do the next right thing. And pretty much I've been able to do that so far.
Thank you so much for being on the program, sharing this.
Thank you.
Lamont Armstrong was released from prison in June after spending 17 years incarcerated for a crime he didn't commit. Teresa Newman is a clinical law professor and co-director of the Duke Law School's Wrongful Convictions Clinic and one of Lamont's attorneys. We're at the Triad Stage, downtown Greensboro, Law and Order Week, and our program continues in a moment. Please stay with us.
Tell Mother it's cold, it's gonna get colder. I'm used to the frost and the winter chill. I'm getting old, but I'm not getting older. I paid the cost, tell Mother I will. Tell Mother the world is losing the battle. I'll be the one to finish the fight. The flag is unfurled with a shake and a rattle. No daughter or son, but Mother is light. Tell Mother, stranger and friend, sister and brother, again tell Mother, tell Mother, when you get to the end, love one another while you still can. Love one another while you still can.